Hello and welcome to The Sector, the radio show podcast discussing nonprofit, social justice, and activism. With me, your host, Ethan Clow, broadcasting on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. Well, I hope you had a wonderful Canada Day long weekend. It's been very beautiful out, incredibly warm, just fantastic weather here in Vancouver, and I hope it's been fantastic wherever you are, if you're listening abroad. We have a fantastic show today, lots to discuss. We have an interview with an organization known as Charity Science. And you might ask yourself, what is Charity Science about? Well, you will soon find out. But before we get onto that, I just wanted to give a quick thanks to everyone who tuned in last week. You may have noticed that we had a slight technical problem with The Sector in our last 2 weeks. So we re-aired episode 12 last week, and that included our interview with Chris Brandt of Music Heals. So my thanks to Chris for being patient with us, and for you listeners being patient with us. This is episode 13, Lucky 13, and we have just a lot of great content on today to discuss, including a new big question and a pitch of the week. And that pitch of the week will be from Zio Kakawa, who is the executive director of Charity Science, and we'll get her take on, well, exactly what it means to be an effective and ethical charity from the sense of science, but also from mission and scope. So it should be a fantastic interview. Stay tuned for that. And in the meantime, we're also going to be discussing some interesting sports related. You may have noticed that the World Cup has been going on in Brazil, the FIFA World Cup, of course. Recent matches, only a little while ago. I've been tweeting about them, if you haven't noticed. But fantastic displays of athleticism and some really amazing matches going on there for soccer, or as the rest of the world understands it, as football. I still don't really understand why we don't call it football, but nevertheless. But actually, we're going to take a bit of a more focused look on North American sports. You may have heard of the controversy surrounding sports teams named after Native American tribes, or here in Canada, First Nations people. What do you think about that? Does that seem offensive to you to have, you know, a hockey team or a football team named after an entire group of people? Some of these teams make the claim that these are meant as tokens of respect and honor. Well, let's consider that, and when we come back from the break, we will have our interview with Zio Kakawa of Charity Science. Stay tuned.
Class, shut up! Shut up and listen to me right now. This is Fred Schneider, and you're listening to CITR. Shut up and listen to this radio station.
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts in the UBC and Kitsilano area at
The Australian Boot Company, Banyan Books and Sound, The Bike Kitchen, The Cove, Dentry's Pub, Displace Hashery, Limelight Video, The Eatery, Fresh's Best Salsa, Gargoyle's Bar and Grill, Lotusland Tattoo, Nuba Kitsilano, Prussian Music, Rufus's Guitar Shop, and the UBC Bookstore.
Wow, it sure does pay to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus, or go online to www.citr.ca.
Keep smiling, keep shining, knowing you can always count on me. For sure.
Joining us now on The Sector is Zio Kakawa, Executive Director of Charity Science. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So first, tell us a little bit about Charity Science. What do you do as an organization?
So what we do at Charity Science is we apply science to doing good. So there's lots of studies already out there about what works and what doesn't, but they're kind of hidden away in these dry academic articles filled with graphs and scary Greek letters. So what we do is we kind of translate that into a more accessible English. So you could kind of call us the popular science of charity. And then we help donors find the charities that have the most evidence base behind them so that they know that when they donate, they're actually doing good for the world.
As an organization, then, you're focused on sort of two aspects. You're rating and evaluating a charity, and you're using scientific methods to do so.
Yeah. We actually don't end up giving ratings to all the charities because that would just be unfeasible given how many charities there are out there and everything. What we do is we just kind of narrow it down to these are the top charities that have, you know, the most scientific evidence supporting them and the most rigorous sort of science. And then also that are super cost effective so that, you know, and this cost effectiveness isn't like, you know, overhead ratios. It's more to do with if you give the charity a dollar, how much good comes from that, right? Doesn't matter how they spend it, as long as they spend it in a way that like the world is a better place at the end of it.
Okay, well, let's talk a bit about sort of the scope of charity science then. Do you only focus on registered charities or all nonprofits?
So, you know, in like, we kind of focus on charities currently, but feasibly, like, our mission statement is more to do with doing the most good per dollar given. So this could be anywhere from, you know, charities to nonprofits. We could even feasibly support a for-profit if that turned out to be the best way to help. For-profits generally are self-funding, though, so usually you're not giving the money.
Well, usually.
Yeah, usually. But, you know, it could. So we like to keep it as broad as possible within the scope of giving dollars to make the world a better place.
And is there a different methodology? For example, you know, not all nonprofits have a charitable focus. Some nonprofits focus on, like, a golf club. So, for instance, how do you approach different causes and apply a methodology to them that makes sense for that particular cause?
So when it comes to like golf courses or say like building an opera house and stuff like that, while I recognize those like in a way make the world a better place, we tend to focus on where like ultimately people are happier because of the result or like have less suffering. And generally speaking, opera houses aren't very cost effective for that because the people going to these institutions are usually quite well off to begin with. So, you know, we try and focus, like, usually you can make much more of a difference in somebody whose life is really, really bad and bringing them up as opposed to taking somebody, you know, who's really well off, has a great life and everything, but spilled their latte. You know, we don't, like, that's probably not going to be very cost effective.
I see. Yeah. So you're a very a classist organization.
Well, in a way, we try and prioritize. Basically, how this all came about is I remember when I was younger, I watched this really moving documentary about this woman who lived in a dump in the Philippines. And, you know, occasionally there would be these people who'd come in and they'd compact all the houses, like a trash compactor, right? Because technically you're not supposed to be living in the dump. Not that these people really had a choice. And one time the woman said that when they came to compact the house, her child was still in there. And it was at that moment that I really realized, holy crap, I really have to do something. I live such a privileged life. I've kind of lived in this little isolated bubble of, like, you know, niceness that's in Canada, right? And I realized that not everybody's so lucky. So, and then I realized, well, you know, I should probably learn about as much as possible what's going wrong so that I can help the best. And as I went through a few months of learning about everything I could, about everything wrong with the world, I wasn't very easy to get along with at the time, I realized there's so much going wrong, I can't possibly help everybody, right? So how do I prioritize? How do I make the most impact given my situation? And so that led me to prioritizing. And the thing is that while I think all causes are valuable, well, not all of them, but most of them are valuable, you know, there are ones where you can have a disproportionate amount of impact, so I want to focus on that because I want to help as many people as possible, or animals, you know, whatever.
Okay. Well, on your website, you state that you aren't paid by charities to look at them, evaluate them. So how do you pick those charities that you do examine?
So I think it's actually quite important that I don't actually get paid by the charities I support because that introduces a whole bunch of bias. If I'm paid by an organization to say that they're the best, you can't really trust my opinion because, well, where am I getting my paycheck from? So what we do instead is we look at all of the independent studies run on them, external to the organization, and then use that to narrow it down to a cause and then pick a charity within that cause. So, for example, there is deworming, which is there's a lot of children in the developing world. They have these intestinal worms that make it really difficult to go about daily life. It makes them anemic, so they're really tired. It gives them abdominal pain, and just it's just not fun to have worms in you. And it's really cheap to get rid of them. And we have tons and tons of clinical trials showing that if you just give them a couple of these pills, they will get rid of the intestinal worms, and they'll be able to go to school more often. It's actually the most cost-effective way to go to school, get more education for people in the third world, and also, you know, less pain and, you know, suffering and all that. So it's pretty good. So we found all these studies about that, and then we looked for charities within that area that were, you know, had good leadership, had a good track record, and also, very importantly, are transparent, you know, so they could have all the evidence base in the world. They could have great leadership and a great track record. But if they don't share that information with the public, it's really hard to make that evaluation. And also, it's really hard to trust them. You know, why aren't they being transparent? Why can't they show this stuff to the public? So that's kind of the super quick way of narrowing it down. Additionally, to make it clear, charity science is more of the popular science. So we actually don't necessarily do this research ourselves. We actually rely on an organization called GiveWell. And GiveWell does all this research, and they're super rigorous. They're based out of San Francisco, and I love them to bits. However, they are very academic. They have all the citations, they have all the graphs, and they just have the graphs. They don't have any pictures, they don't have any jokes. It's much more like what you'd find in an academic article, which I think is fantastic, but it's rather intimidating. So we're more of the side that takes that information and, you know, adds some comics, makes it a little bit more interesting, like this podcast. Unless you're not liking what I'm saying, at which point the website's completely different, you know.
So what happens if you say you examine a charity and you don't find it's very efficient, or it's not particularly utilizing its resources correctly, and you put that information out there? What happens if the charity says, hold on a second, this is libelous, we're going to sue you? What do you do then?
So that's actually exactly why we don't put out those negative reviews. I really think that the way charities should react to this sort of stuff is if there's like an external review and there's all these sorts of evidence showing that what they're doing isn't working very well, I really wish that what charities would do is update based on the evidence, you know, and say, okay, this is really important information. How can I improve from this? But unfortunately, yes, you're right. The reaction is usually this is libel. So what we tend to do is we give examples and we anonymize the charity that did it. And there's also the additional benefit of not only do we not get, you know, into sticky legal situations, we also get the benefit of a lot of the times when somebody hears that, you know, say like, you know, some X charity is really bad and they did this thing that's like, you know, awful, they'll just not donate to that one charity. And they won't realize that a lot of charities do this. This isn't like isolated case, right? So what we really want is to people to realize that lots of charities can do a lot of silly things. And I'm not saying they have negative intentions or anything, but, you know, it's really hard to do good. We need to have more than good intentions. We need to have good intentions and good outcomes. So it's good to generalize and say, you know, charities do this. Let's think critically about which charities to donate to instead of just donating to whoever, you know, whichever friend is doing a fundraiser or, you know, whatever you hear about in the radio or something.
So let's talk about the science aspect here. So where does science fit in with nonprofits or fundraising or the mission and the cause? How do we evaluate these things?
That's a great question. So the best way to do it is, you may have heard of it, it's called the randomized control trial. And I'll just talk about it by giving an example. Like, say you're a charity and you build wells, you know, and you think that building wells is fantastic because, you know, you get a clean source of water, and then since you have a clean source of water, you're less likely to get ill, and also you have more time to do other things in your day instead of collecting water. So you can actually test to see if this is true. So what you could do is say you only have the funding to fund 100 wells, right? What you can do is you can pick 200 villages that need wells and flip a coin to see which village will get a well and which won't. Then you build the wells in the villages that you've selected randomly. It's really important that it be random, because otherwise it could be some other factor that causes the difference. And then you follow up a year later and you measure how sick they get from waterborne diseases. And you can say, hey, look, in the villages that had the wells, they got sick a lot less often. But hey, it turns out in the villages with the wells, without the wells, also didn't get sick very often. Maybe something else was happening. Or maybe you'll find that there's a huge difference between the two, and then the wells were actually useful. But a lot of the time what will happen is people will look at, you know, the village before and after the well and say, look, people are getting less sick. But you're not the only actor here, right? There's tons of other people. There's the people who are getting the wells themselves. Maybe they discovered something that they could do themselves without the help of an external factor. Maybe the government came in with a new program that chlorinated the water. That was the thing that caused it. So you really have to check and make sure that, you know, it's because of you, not because of other random factors.
We're talking about, like, science fields here. So, you know, psychology, sociology, social sciences. Which ones do you find most useful in determining effectiveness of a charity?
Well, I actually find that it's, you know, doing the science of charity itself, focusing explicitly on that, it's very hard to infer from something like a psychology study and infer that, which is typically done on, you know, upper middle class white students at a college. It's way better to actually go into the field and test the very specific intervention that you're trying out in the country you're trying to do it, because country to country varies, right? So there's actually an organization that I'm a huge fan of. It's called the Innovations for Poverty Action, IPA for short. And what they do is they actually go out in the field, they partner with a charity, and they take actual proper academics, and they go into the field, they do the randomized control trial, and then also what they do is they summarize that information and try and influence governments with it. So this is very, very specific to charities, which is really, really helpful and also practical. You know, at the end of the day, it's really helpful to have a study done on a specific intervention rather than a theoretical, you know, model of how things work, because, you know, the world's really complicated. The steps between thinking that, you know, X works in the perfect theoretical world and going from that to, like, you know, should we build wells, there's a lot of inferential gaps there. So
mm-hmm. So when you're examining the effectiveness of a charity, you're not just looking at their ledgers and their budgets, you're looking at the long-term effect of their mission, their cause.
Yeah, definitely. And I actually think that, looking at their ledgers and the budgets and everything, I think this is like one of the first baby steps to looking at charities critically and has really captured the public's imagination. But I really think that we need to go a step further, because sure, if, you know, a charity is spending, you know, 99% of their budget on, you know, like, you know, a CEO's Ferrari or whatever, this isn't very good. But if they are, you know, spending only 1% on, you know, the CEO's salary, and the rest of it goes to a program that doesn't work, that's also not terribly useful, right?
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, you really want to actually cause the world to be a better place at the end of the day, not just to feel warm fuzzies, although warm fuzzies are also quite nice.
Right. Well, I mean, in terms of, like, mission and cause, you're going to get so many different opinions on what is a paramount priority in the nonprofit sector. You've been talking a lot about, you know, intervention in sort of international the international realm, poverty, building wells, that sort of thing. But there are plenty of people who will say, no, we need to refocus our attention here and deal with Canadian issues. I mean, and like, we could sit here for like 25 minutes and just list charities that are operating locally. So, I mean, there's going to be a certain amount of guesswork then, isn't there, in determining which cause is more important?
So the thing is between the different outcomes, you can have it be really hard to compare. So for example, like, you know, psychological suffering versus physical suffering, that can be really hard to really think that ultimately you can't compare those two, as much as I would like to say that. However, you can get ballpark figures. So for example, and the thing is that I love my country and I really think there are lots of pressing issues here. The thing is that you can use some broad rules of thumb to see where you could have more of an impact with the same amount of effort. Canada is one of the wealthiest countries in the world, and also one of the happiest, you know, so we haven't just squandered our wealth and, you know, are super unhappy, you know. We are, like, you know, the only country happier than us is Sweden. God damn you, Sweden. So we're actually quite well off, and among the people who, and we've gotten all the low-hanging fruit when it comes to suffering, right? So, for example, all of our water is chlorinated, for the most part, like 99.9%. Nobody's starving. We've got the basics and healthcare, and what we have left are those really hard-to-deal-with issues. So, for example, we've got drug addictions, right? These are really important. They cause huge amounts of suffering, but we don't really know how to fix it. It's really hard, right? We can spend decades and decades trying to fix this, but we don't really know what the solution is. Whereas in Africa, there are problems that we know the solution to. They're really cheap to implement. The only thing that we lack is the will to do so. And so, you know, so for example, water chlorination. It's one of those things that we take for granted, but you know, if you imagine trying to drink from a pool where, you know, livestock have just been wading around in, you can really start to grasp just how awful that is and scary, and be like, oh, well, you know, that's really easy to fix. We know what to do, and we can help way more people with the same amount of money. So it ultimately comes down to a personal decision, you know, and, you know, I'm no one to say that, you know, you can't donate locally. But if you really want to help the most people with your dollar, it's probably better to help in the third world rather than the first.
Well, I mean, first of all, on the subject of Canadian disparity, I mean, we do have a lot of hunger in Canada. We do have a lot of water issues in Canada. Something like, you know, 65% of our First Nations populations doesn't have clean drinking water. So there are huge issues in Canada.
Yes. Oh, and there are. It's just a lot of the times those issues are there for, like, reasons that are harder to fix, essentially. I remember actually looking into this because I was, like, hearing about these third world conditions in Native communities. And I actually looked it up and I looked at the figures. And, you know, they typically make about half as much as the average person in Canada, which is awful. That income disparity makes me really sad and ashamed of our country for having that happen. But at the same time, I looked at that and I looked at their wages compared to the average Kenyan wages. And the average Kenyan makes a 40th of the amount that the Native Americans here make. So, and that income disparity is huge as well, and also fills me with that same sort of sadness. And it's a lot easier to help those people and help more of them. So it basically just comes down to if you view all people as equal, just going wherever you can help the most people. And I would totally help in Canada if that was the place to do it. But generally speaking, it's easier to help more people overseas.
But looking at sort of the charitable sector, isn't it a closed system in that if you help out, say, people here locally and you raise more people up to a sustainable amount, like you raise more people who are in the poverty level to the middle class level or higher, now they have more disposable income, now they're making able to make donations. I mean, isn't it eventually going to even out regardless of where you're investing, as long as you're investing in, you know, human capital and human growth and human, you know, survival?
That's definitely the case. Of course, this also happens in the third world. Surprising statistic, poorer people are actually more likely to give more to charity in percentages than the richer people. What does it say about the richer people? I don't know. So that happens in both countries. And then additionally, you have to think, you know, these people that you help locally, they're going to help more. But you're going to be helping more people in a third world. So you have to think, you know, which adds up to being more people in the end.
Okay, well, why don't we shift gears and talk a bit more about what a charity can do to become more effective, using science, relying on the evidence that's available. So typically speaking, what would you like to see charities do more of in terms of scientifically evaluating their cause and mission?
So one thing that I would love for them to do is to really analyze what ultimately they're trying to do, right? So a lot of the times they get caught up in these more easy to recognize metrics. So for example, they'll be like, I want more kids in after school care programs or something like that. But ultimately when they think and they say, like, well, why do I want them in after school care programs? It's like, oh, because I want them to do better in school because they'll have more access to, people who are like good role models. And then because they have better access to school and better grades, they'll be able to get a better job and thus be happier at the end, or have more money. You can look at either of those. And then you can say, okay, well, what's the best way to get them to do better at school? There's tons and tons of research on this, and you can go through it. So, for example, just today I was reading about, you may have seen the really cool TED Talk where they put computers in these Indian slums and then let kids play with them, whatever they wanted. And these kids taught themselves all sorts of cool things, right? So what they did is, instead of just being like, oh, that's a cool idea, we should do that, IPA went in and studied that and compared it to just giving kids who are already in school remedial tutoring. So giving them like a tutor to help them with the stuff they were struggling on. And both the tutoring and the computers helped with student achievement quite a lot. However, it was about 5 times more expensive to set up the computer than it was to hire tutors. And then also with the tutors, you support local jobs, which is also really good. So while both of them work, if you look at the research, you can actually focus on the thing that will help more people achieve your goal. So if charities started doing that, like actually looking through the research, I think that they could help a lot more people.
Hmm. Okay, well, tell us sort of the opposite now. Tell us some of the blunders that you've seen made by charities, and please name names.
Oh, I'm gonna actually still keep it anonymous just because charities are not fond of me telling the world about all the things they did wrong. But so I've had a fair few. So one charity that I worked for that will remain anonymous, they were doing some work and they actually got all this data back to see what whether it was actually having an impact or not. And the data came back and, nothing had changed. All the money that they'd been pouring into it hadn't changed the outcomes. And I was thinking, okay, well, they're going to update based on the evidence. They're going to try something new, They're going to be shocked and horrified by this and actually do something about it. But the executive director took a look at the data and said, oh, well, imagine what would have happened if we hadn't been there. Right? What would have happened if we hadn't spent the money? Then it would have been worse. And this is an example of looking at data, and there's no way that the data could show that you were wrong. This is not falsifiable. And if that's the case, then you can't possibly learn from it. So one thing is to, and one way to actually avoid doing this in the first place, is when you start the study, say to yourself, if this result comes in, I'll do this. Set up some if this happens, then I'll do some, I'll change my actions in such a way so that it's harder for you to rationalize after the fact and actually, change and become a better charity. Some other blunders. I think one of the biggest blunders is just, frankly, not looking at the data and always just saying there's a reason why it doesn't apply to us. It doesn't apply to us because of this or that. And seeing science and the results that come from it as kind of this thing that makes charity, less from the heart, I really think that the reason why I'm so into these numbers and I really want science to be out there is because I care so much that I really, really want things to work, And with the numbers, you can make things better. It's a learning tool rather than just a tool of criticism or a tool to show just how awesome you are.
Okay, all right. Well, let's then turn the tables a little bit. Tell us about charity science in terms of your funding and your performance.
So for funding, we get funded from independent donors, and they fund us just because they like what we're doing. They want to spread the idea of giving in an evidence-based way. And all the rest of the money that we raise goes directly to the charities. We really try and make it so that you're not supporting us, you're supporting the charities themselves. In terms of our output, What we ultimately are looking for is to make the world a happier place, so for people to be more happy, less depressed, and also for there to be less physical pain. For the happiness, there's a whole bunch of metrics that psychologists have developed that they've tested for internal and external validity and all that sort of stuff, where they ask questions like, on a scale of 1 to 10, how satisfied are you with your life? You know, on a scale, like, how many times in the last week have you felt, you know, miserable and sad? How many times in the last week have you felt joyful? All these sorts of questions. You can add these up and to make kind of like, you know, how IQ measures intelligence, where they add up all these different things and kind of give you a number at the end. You can do that with happiness, too. And then, for physical suffering, there's a really cool metric that the World Health Organization has uses or developed, I can't remember, and it's called the Disability Adjusted Life Years, DALY for short. And DALY, what it does is it looks at all the different illnesses and had a whole bunch of experts and people who suffered from these different, you know, diseases and stuff to kind of rank them on how bad they were, essentially. So, you know, like if you have like a toothache, you know, that might be like a, you know, a, you know, 50% suffering or something. And but if you have cancer, it would be like a 90% and stuff like that. And so you can kind of, from that, see where you reduce the most physical suffering. Once again, this doesn't take into account psychological suffering. It's really hard to get the perfect metric, but you can definitely narrow things down and get a ballpark estimate.
Interesting. Okay, well, since we're running out of time, let's go on to our favorite segment here on The Sector. This is where we ask our guests for their pitch of the week. So this could be a pitch for a charity or a cause or anything that you think is worthy. And, you know, so imagine that you've cornered a billionaire in the room, you know, maybe in an elevator, and they say, you know, you have a minute of my time. Tell me what you're working on and why I should give to it.
Alrighty. So, you know, I would start off by explaining that, you know, science has revolutionized the way the world works. You know, it's one of the most powerful tools that humans have ever discovered. You can look at things like medicine, where we've gone from, you know, leeching and astrology to, you know, doubling or even tripling their lifespan from what it used to be. If we turn this powerful tool towards charity and making the world a better place, I can only imagine, you know, how much the world will change. We could eliminate poverty, just make it history. And so that's what Charity Science does. So, you know, please, Mr. Millionaire, check out our website at charityscience.com.
Excellent. Well, I'm sure that will convince many millionaires. Well, we are out of time, so thank you again for joining us. And, of course, for any listeners who want to learn more about Charity Science, where would they go?
So charityscience.com. We also have a Facebook page at Charity Science. So those are the best places to go.
Excellent. All right. Well, we will return after the break here on The Sector.
I imagined what it would be like to be a wizard, and then I pretended and acted in that way on the day.
Studies show that 9 out of 10 wizards prefer CITR 101.9 FM.
If we were to draw a graph of my process, of my method, something like this, Sir Ian, Sir Ian, Sir Ian, action. Wizard, you shall not pass! Cut! Sir Ian, Sir Ian, Sir Ian.
Jazz is a word that means many different things to many different people. The best definition of jazz that I know of is the jazz show on CITR with yours truly, Gavin Walker. Monday nights, 9 to midnight, with the jazz feature at 11 o'clock. Check us out every Monday.
And we are back on The Sector here on CITR with me, Ethan Clow, your host. So our thanks to Zio for joining us here and talking about Charity Science. Fabulous stuff. I actually just want to make a quick correction to a mistake that I made. I believe in the interview I made reference to the amount of unsafe drinking water for First Nations communities here in Canada. I believe I just said around 60% have unsafe access to drinking water. I just wanted to correct that. So in looking at an article that was posted on the CBC, and I'll have a link to this in our show notes, there was a categorization of the water quality throughout Canada based on province to province. So for instance, 39% of water systems in Manitoba were listed as high risk, meaning there were major deficiencies that pose a risk to water quality and could jeopardize health and safety. An additional 34% were assessed as a medium risk, saying that these issues need to be corrected, but were not as severe as high risk. So if you were to sort of take into account both numbers, you would arrive at around 60% in terms of, well, a little higher than 60% actually, in terms of how dangerous the water was in Manitoba. More than half of the water systems in BC for the First Nations reserves, about 46% of those were considered high risk. Additionally, Ontario also had about 46% in terms of high risk water systems. So I just wanted to put that out there because we are sort of talking about some of the issues related to First Nations with regards to sports in this case, but I didn't want to get any of the water issues wrong because I know that's very important and urgently requires significant activism and resources. Now, just a reminder that if you notice any other mistakes or inaccuracies here on The Sector, we do encourage you to write in and complain. Well, I mean, not complain, but correct us. If you have extra information that we don't have, we would love to have it. So you can tweet us at Sector Podcast or tweet me at Ethan Clow. We're also on Facebook at facebook.com/sectorpodcast. And you can email us at sectorpodcast@gmail.com. And of course, if you visit us online, please go to sectorpodcast.wordpress.com, where we'll have all the show notes as well as the podcast download links. And you are free to comment and find more ways to contact us and let us know if we've screwed up, because if we have, we need to fix it. So anyway, I look forward to your complaints. Just kidding. I look forward to your criticisms. I mean, I look forward to your interactions with me. That's what I meant to say. Well, let's go on with the additional topic today here on The Sector. And I already mentioned it, but let's talk a little bit about the use, perhaps the misappropriation, of First Nations names, tribal names, or in some cases, actual racist insults. Some of these team names include the Atlanta Braves in the Major League Baseball, Cleveland Indians, the Edmonton Eskimos in the Canadian Football League, and the Chicago Blackhawks in the NHL. There's also a dozen or so mascots, college teams, junior and minor teams that have very similar names. Now, the majority, though, in the last couple of years, the lightning rod that has created this controversy and sustained it has definitely been the NFL. Now, there's a couple teams that have First Nations-related names or mascots, for example, the Kansas City Chiefs. But there is one team in particular, and I know you all know it, and that, of course, is the Washington football team. Now, you'll notice that I didn't actually say its real name, and this is something that has come up in discourse on the name. The idea being that it's actually not really a name. It's just an insult. It would be like calling a hockey team or a baseball team a racial slur. And indeed, in any other context, this name is a racial slur. So I'm not going to repeat it on the radio. And I actually encourage most people, when you refer to this football team, refer to them by the Washington football team, because we don't want to lend any kind of credence or normalization of this racial slur. Now, this controversy has been going on for a very long time, and the question, I think appropriately, is raised, should these teams rename themselves? And should they adopt names that, you know, frankly don't offend a whole bunch of people or marginalize an already marginalized people? Now, typically the response is that these names are tokens of respect, that they are meant to be taken as praise and high esteem. Now, I think that it's a little bit disingenuous to say that some of these names should be interpreted that way. Now, I think that we can all agree that there are more offensive names and less offensive names. The Chicago Blackhawks, I would suggest, are a less offensive name than the Washington football team's name. Now, it doesn't mean that the Chicago Blackhawks is an okay name or that we shouldn't also be offended by it, but that there is a degree here in terms of outrageousness. And of course, the rallying cry for the people who oppose a name change, of course, label this as political correctness run amok. Now, I want to play a short clip. This was a public service announcement that was aired on TV during some pretty high-profile sporting events in America. This is produced by various Native American coalitions. And I just want you to listen to this and think about it, and then we'll come back to me here on the sector.
Proud. Forgotten. Indian. Navajo. Blackfoot. Inuit and Sioux. Survivor. Spiritualist. Patriot. Sitting Bull, Hiawatha, and Jim Thorpe. Mother, father, son, daughter, chief. Mills, Geronimo. Unyielding, strong, indomitable. Native Americans call themselves many things. The one thing they don't.
That video ends with an image of the Washington football team's helmet and logo, making clear the point that they would never call themselves that racial slur. It's a very powerful video. I encourage you to watch it. I'll have a link to it in our show notes. Now, what's interesting about this, of course, is that this is a really, what some have argued, a really good marketing move to make more people aware of just how ludicrous it is to assume that these terms are meant to be signs of respect, especially in the case of the Washington football team. One of the common arguments made, of course, is that if you were to replace the Native Indian content with any other ethnic or minority group, whether it be Black people, Asian people, Muslims, Hindus, even French or German or Polish, you would have no clear reason not to call those displays outwardly racist. If you had a team that displayed a caricature of a Jewish person and used some offensive words for Jews as a team moniker, I don't think any of us would really bat an eyelash at saying that's a pretty despicable display of racism, and it's being cloaked in this veneer of patriotism and sportsmanship, and it's got to stop. Now, the other question, of course, is what about the other team names? And I mentioned that, you know, we can probably agree that some of them are not quite as racist as others. The Chicago Blackhawks are not quite as offensive as the Washington football team. But what do you think about that? Do you think that the Chicago Blackhawks are not quite as offensive? Maybe they are. Maybe that's just my own bias as a hockey fan. One of the interesting things with regards to the Chicago Blackhawks is it's almost impossible to find the actual history in relation to the Chicago Blackhawks' name. If you look at the Chicago Blackhawks Wikipedia page, it's almost completely absent. You have to do some digging around on the internet to find out the original origin of the name, and it's not even all that clear either. Basically, the Blackhawks are named after the Blackhawk Chief, who was an American Indian who was fighting against the United States Army, trying to maintain control of their ancestral lands. And, you know, you don't need to look at the history books to know that, of course, he lost that battle, and the United States Army was able to sort of occupy the entirety of the continent when it came to Indian land. The Blackhawks team name actually comes from the American Military Blackhawk Division from World War II, and the division was named after the chief. So in a way, the team is named after a military division named after a Native American tribe leader who fought a war against the United States, a very bloody war that resulted in a lot of death, a lot of misery. So, I mean, it's an conflicting situation, I think, for a hockey fan, because on the one hand, the Chicago Blackhawks are one of the original six. There's a lot of great history and tradition associated with that hockey team, and yet they are named after a chief who tried to reclaim ancestral land, fought in a bloody, horrendous war, was captured, paraded around America, and then a battalion in World War II, I guess, taking on that bloody conflict vibe, named themselves after the Blackhawks, and then that in turn was where one of the original owners of the team fought in the war and decided to name his hockey team after it. So, complicated issue there. One of the unfortunate aspects with the Chicago Blackhawks, of course, is the iconography. Now, it's not quite as offensive as the Cleveland Indians, for example, but a lot of their fans, Chicago Blackhawks fans, will wear headdresses, feathers, to games, there's team events that they go to dressed up like this. And that, again, you're dressing up like a minority group of people who have been oppressed and marginalized. It's not a costume party. You're actually dressing up as a group of people. In a way, it's not terribly flattering for them. So, again, put some perspective on the idea of perhaps it's time to relook at some of these names. What do you think, listeners? Do you think that the Chicago Blackhawks need to reconsider a name change and a logo redesign, particularly if the Washington football team undergoes the same thing? Do you think that there is a hypocrisy in calling for a name change in one organization but not another? Or at least imagining or telling ourselves that certain sports teams that are named after Indians or Native Americans or tribes or individuals, that some of them are offensive and racist and some of them aren't? Is that just us kind of trying to find a way to justify it to ourselves? Well, I look forward to your commentary on that as well. Let's go on to our big question of the week, as we are running out of time here on The Sector. The big question of the week here on The Sector. This is where I pose a question to our listening audience, and I ask them something provocative, something to consider in regards to social justice or nonprofits or activism. And I ask you to think about it, to really discuss it in your heads, in your conversations with your friends and your colleagues, and let us know what you think. You can tweet us at Sector Podcast or tweet me at Ethan Clow, or you can comment on Facebook or on our website, sectorpodcast.wordpress.com, or even email us at sectorpodcast@gmail.com. And we debate it. We discuss your answers here on the show next week, and I will throw in my own two cents, and we'll try to arrive at some kind of conclusion, or maybe, if not conclusion, at least a new way of looking at things. Now, I would love to get your feedback on the renaming issue in terms of sports teams that are named after First Nations, Native Americans. I would love to get your feedback on that. Additionally, I want you to consider this big question. Does protesting work? Protesting. We've all seen the demonstrations. We've all seen people out on the streets with signs, banners, sleek t-shirts and slogans, chanting. Do you think that works? Does that convince anybody of anything? You know, we all saw the Occupy movement that happened here in Vancouver and many major cities across North America and the world. Did it have an impact? Did it do anything? I don't know. Did it? You tell me. Let me know what you think about protesting. There's many different ways to protest. There's peaceful protesting where you're sitting cross-legged with a guitar, maybe singing some tunes with friends, to angry chants, to throwing stones and getting violent. And of course, I am not advocating violence, but I do want to hear your thoughts on this. Can there be an effective protest that involves violence, maybe? I guess it all depends on what you're protesting and how serious the issue is. So there's lots to think about there, lots to discuss, and get back to us. Remember, email at sectorpodcast@gmail.com or on Twitter or on Facebook. We would love to hear your responses. Let's just take a quick break here on The Sector, and when we return, we will wrap up the show after this.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taken to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective. News 101 is Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced student and community newscast, bringing you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective. Tune in Mondays and Fridays at 5 p.m. right here on CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver. Live streaming and podcasts are available online at citr.ca.
And we're back here on The Sector, discussing nonprofit social justice and activism here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver with me, Ethan Clow. And we are actually wrapping up for another week here on the show. Again, my thanks to all of you who have tuned in, are listening live right now, or are listening via podcast. We really appreciate it. Please tell your friends about us because we think we can help a whole lot of people. And that's not just me being a little bit presumptuous. I actually think that we've got a lot of great content here. My thanks to Zio Kikawa from Charity Science. If you'd like to learn more about Charity Science, we will have their website, Facebook page, Twitter account, all their contact information that you need to get in touch with them on our webpage at sectorpodcast.wordpress.com. If you have any thoughts, considerations, questions, feel free to contact us. And if you have any suggestions for charities or nonprofits or great thinkers that you would like to have on the show, please let me know. And if you are a great thinker or a nonprofit or a charity and you would like to be on the show, please let me know at sectorpodcast@gmail.com and I'll be more than happy to have you on the show. Well, this is Ethan Clow saying thanks again for tuning into The Sector. We will see you next week.